The Ku Iluna, please rise.
Kia ka aha ho kolo kolo ki ki hano hano u a ko ko ho mai la. This honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Velina, makamoku puni o ahu I kamoku o kona e ano kanko ma aliolani hale. Greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at aliolani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000364, Novatech Capital Inc., Respondent Plaintiff Appellee versus Martin Cao, Petitioner Defendant Cross Claim Defendant Appellant, and Pacmar Technologies LLC, Respondent Nominal Defendant Cross Claimant Appellee. Arguing for Petitioner Martin Cao, Keith M. Kiyuchi. Arguing for Respondent Novatech Capital Inc., David M. Louie. Also appearing is Jesse Scheel and Nick Monlux. Argument on the merits.
Aloha Awinala, good afternoon. And today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. And I'd like to welcome and thank our substitute justices in this case, Judge Rebecca Copeland and Judge Brian Costa. Thank you for joining us. Counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. Court has allowed 30 minutes for each side, and Mr. Kiyuchi, I understand you intend to argue for 20 minutes and have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Louie, you will have 30 minutes with a three-minute warning. Mr. Kiyuchi, please proceed.
Thank you. Justices of the Supreme Court, my name is Keith Kiyuchi. I represent Martin Cao. This matter is before you on a very limited issue. The issue is whether or not the arbitrator should have continued the arbitration proceeding because Mr. Cao invoked his Fifth Amendment rights at that proceeding and elected not to testify. We argue as a general matter that Mr. Cao's ability to defend himself in the civil proceeding was greatly restricted by his not being able to testify. At the time, Mr. Cao had been charged with a federal offense, specifically a violation of the PPP law. He was then indicted subsequently on May 6, 2021. So he was actually indicted before the arbitration hearing occurred, but he was not indicted at the time that the motion was made by previous counsel to stay proceedings. And that was held before Arbitrator Hyatt. So this court had limited the acceptance to those issues and specifically had asked counsel in the supplemental briefing whether there are any additional protections afforded by the Hawaii Constitution as opposed to the United States Constitution. And it would make a difference here because the primary case that has been used throughout is the Keating case out of the Ninth Circuit. And there may be protections, I would argue, that are afforded by the Hawaii Constitution that are not necessarily afforded by the United States Constitution. But the Hawaii law in this area is very limited. We're kind of limited to really two cases. Case cited by me, the Kaneshiro v. Belisario case, which is a 1970 case, and a case cited by the opposition, which is Ramil v. Keller. There's a distinct difference between the two cases. So in Kaneshiro v. Belisario, the Hawaii Supreme Court, in quoting Justice Stewart, wrote a very strong comment on the rights of an individual to the Fifth Amendment and said that the litigant in that case had a right to assert his right against self-incrimination. That case was not about whether or not the person could testify. It was about whether there can be an inference that the person didn't testify. And you can use that one case because it kind of goes beyond some of the federal cases. For example, the case, there are a couple of cases cited. One is Doe Rudy Glanzer v. Glanzer in the Ninth Circuit, and it cites the Baxter v. Palmigiano United States Supreme Court case. Both of those cases were about an inference of a party not to testify. And they allowed the inference to occur even where the party invoked the Fifth Amendment. That wasn't the case in Canicio versus Belisario, where they say the inference of being silent could not be held against the party that invoked the Fifth Amendment. The Ramil v. Keller case can be distinguished because Ramil v. Keller is really about not producing information. And in that case, the Supreme Court wrote, one is not exonerated from producing information merely because doing so would incriminate them. So that was really more about a discovery issue than it was an issue where the party could not testify in their own defense. In this case, we don't have the discovery issue. The record will show that by the time I got into the case, because I think I'm the third counsel in, that the documents had all been produced. There were no privilege asserted, no Fifth Amendment asserted to any of those documents. So all of that was produced, so that was not an issue. The sole issue that was brought before Arbitrator Hyatt was whether or not the proceeding should have been stayed because Mr. Kao could not testify in his own defense in those proceedings. And this court also asked citations for cases which involve a delay or of the arbitration proceedings. And most of those cases, as I cited, are not Hawaii cases.
But, you know, on September 30th, I think it was the fourth day of the arbitration proceedings. At that time, you know, I guess there was some question as to whether NCI might, the arbitrator might need more information regarding the capital accounts in order to reach his decision. And at that time, you opposed any bifurcation.
I did. I did oppose a bifurcation at that time. I think that's a little bit of a different issue, but you're correct. I did oppose a bifurcation. I think my position would have been, was from the get-go.
Because that was before your client was to testify.
Right.
And correct. So, I mean, you opposed, and prior counsel had suggested bifurcation earlier, months earlier, but had not really pursued it. And so, have you maybe not waived the issue? Because if you had requested bifurcation, then you might have a stronger case as to whether or not the arbitrator should have stayed the arbitration.
But I think the problem with the bifurcation in this case, it doesn't resolve, I think, all of the issues. I think the bifurcation still would have put Mr. Kao in a position where even if you bifurcated it, he would not have been able to testify at that arbitration hearing. And his point has always been that he has wanted to testify at the arbitration hearing, but at that point in 2021, he was not able to because of the pending federal case. You know, the federal case obviously changed. I mean, it changed. He pled guilty. Was sentenced by Judge Kobayashi. But I think early on, because in 2021, he had just been indicted literally May of that year, there still remained a lot to be done. So I understand what you're saying, Justice, and you know, it may very well be that that's the inference that goes along with that. But I think at that time, in September of 2021, we're looking at a situation where he's just been indicted. He's still got some defenses to the federal charge, and I think to bifurcate it would not have given him any advantage in terms of the arbitration proceedings. So that's kind of why we proceeded in that manner. Our position would have been that the whole proceeding should have been stayed to really keep Mr. Kao's rights to the Fifth Amendment intact. And they were not. And we've cited several cases that, and they're all outside of Hawaii, One of the cases,
Let me ask you this. So, sure. If the plaintiff had the burden of proof on the claims, does it matter if your client invoked the rights and then doesn't testify at the arbitration proceeding? Does it matter to your argument if the plaintiff had the burden of proof on the claims themselves in arbitration?
I don't think in this case it made a difference, because Mr. Kyle would have testified if he didn't assert the Fifth Amendment. He would have testified, and that in itself, of itself, would have presented a defense. This was a case where, as I said, it's not a discovery issue. We had produced all of the documents so that the plaintiff was able to make their case with the documents they had. They didn't have to make their case by calling Mr. Kyle. They didn't have to make their case by even calling Mr. Lumkey or Mr. Chen, who were the other employees who were subsequently indicted. This was a case that they really made on some employees that they called. They made it on the documents and the records, and those documents were produced. But I think the key is whether or not Mr. Kao was afforded the ability to defend himself. And to those ends, you know, we cited a Second Circuit case, Temple Shane Corp versus Burtek. It says fundamental fairness is what's important in determining whether or not an arbitrator should continue the proceeding. And the court in that case says fundamental fairness requires that arbitrators provide each party with an adequate opportunity to present all evidence to present its argument and argument, but does not require arbitrators to hear all the evidence proffered by a party. So here, it really restricted Mr. Kyle from even testifying and saying XYZ was wrong. That's incorrect. That's the incorrect inference. And I think that's our point. It really comes down to, what did the invocation of the Fifth Amendment prevent in this case? It prevented him from testifying, prevented him from getting a fundamentally fair hearing, because he was the witness in his own defense.
Let me ask you this. So if Article 1, Section 10 of the Hawaii Constitution provides criminal defendants with higher protections than the Fifth Amendment, is your argument that invocation of the Fifth Amendment rights should somehow be weighted heavier than any other factors the court might consider then?
Yeah, that would be one reason why maybe the arbitrator just filing Keating in and of itself would have been wrong, because I think that the right that should have been weighed the heaviest was Mr. Kyle's right against self-incrimination, and that was not considered. If you look at the transcript, the circuit court really just followed Arbitrator Hyatt's decision. Arbitrator Hyatt's decision is by no means short. He does engage in a very long dissertation with Phil Nglima, who's Mr. Kyle's previous counsel, but he doesn't weigh it properly. And one of the factors on that that's kind of important is he weighs factors a lot in favor of the employees and of the company. And one of those key factors turns out to be a non-factor during the arbitration or just prior to the arbitration hearing, and that was the facility clearance status of the company. And that was a big deal, because if they didn't have a facility clearance status, they couldn't have employees access specific materials that were sensitive government.
Yes, but
materials.
There was also still testimony that, you know, if there was additional evidence came, I think there was an officer Shaw or somebody that testified,
right,
that if other additional information came to light or if there were additional charges, that FCL could have been withdrawn. I mean, there was no complete disassociation, which is what they were seeking, right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, that was a decision, however, as limited as it was, where they basically gave back the company's right for the facility clearance status. That was a right for, like you said, Justice McKenna, for a very limited period of time. But that right existed at that point in time, September 2021, and it turns out that right was never revoked by the government. And the company in that respect was hurt. And my point is that that should have been taken into account. It was not taken into account. And the argument, the expert witness we had testified, Larry Allen, that said he did not think, in his opinion, that the facility clearance status of the company would be affected. And he turned out to be right. It was not affected. And you're right. It wasn't affected at that time, but it was subject to review later on. And that's, I think, what the point is that there should have been a much more careful weighing of factors that ran in favor of Mr. Cao, which didn't occur. And that's why we assert, and I think this court was right to ask for additional briefing on what the rights are under the Hawaii Constitution versus the United States Constitution.
Well, you know, what are the factors going to be? I mean, I look at, you know, the sufficient cause from 658A23. I mean, are you equating that to good cause under the Chen Ma? What type of factors are we really looking at? And let me double up a little bit on that. Is there's clearly some balancing. And it does seem that your balancing is weighed heavily to the Fifth Amendment, Article 1, Section 10, specifically, because I don't actually think we're talking about the Fifth Amendment. We're talking about greater protections under Article 1, Section 10. So we're looking at Article 1, Section 10, not the
right.
Now, you have to, I would think, weigh that about against all the prejudice of the delay concerns, you know, whether it's the public or the individual, you know, the employees, the things of that nature. And then you also have this sort of this possible existence of a narrower solution. So, you know, you have Keating, you have some of these other cases, you know, around the nation. And just tell me what your take on would be on the factors that this court should consider.
Well, it's interesting, the sufficient cause phrase is used, but I would argue sufficient cause is a lower standard than good cause. So you then, as I put in my supplemental brief, good cause is really defined by this court in Chen v. Ma, which is
a substantial reason.
Substantial
okay.
reason.
And is your substantial reason simply the Article 1, Section 10? Is there anything else?
I think that's the only reason he didn't testify. But again, the very fact that he didn't testify really impinges on his whole defense on the entire arbitration proceeding. If he wasn't able to testify, there are a lot of defenses or a lot of statements that were not made that could not have been made by anybody else. Because here, Article 1, Section 10 also applied not only to Mr. Cao, but would also apply to the other two employees, Clifford Chen and Kahele Lumkey, that would also have knowledge that would be called to testify. And it turned out Mr. Lumkey and Mr. Chen were charged eventually. So it's a situation where he was really deprived of any ability to present a defense. And I would argue that constitutes, you know, good cause or sufficient cause.
You know, as far as the concreteness, I guess, of the Article 1, Section 10, right? In your initial remarks, you mentioned the stay was sought before Mr. Cao was actually indicted?
No, it was sought. Yeah, you're right. It was sought before he was indicted. He was indicted on May 6, 2021. My recollection is that the motion was filed before that date.
Okay. Now, wouldn't that be a factor, you know, whether somebody is pending investigation, which is, as we know, could just be forever, or the person is actually indicted?
Well, but this case was a little different. He was actually arrested. He was arrested. He was put into custody. He actually...
Well, but, I mean, you know many people who are pending investigation or you know, the arrested RPI, released pending investigation.
I get your argument, Justice. But in this case, he was arrested. He was actually spent some time in the FCI. And then he was released after a bail hearing conducted by the magistrate. I think it was a $2 million bail and subject to an ankle monitor. So it was a lot more, it's a lot different than simply, you know, release pending investigation. And I don't think in this case, factually, anybody thought that he wasn't going to be charged, he wasn't going to be indicted, and eventually he was. I mean, the timing was just, you know, okay. One right after
I think
the
other. I understand. Let me shift a little bit. I thought I heard you say, you know, Mr. Cao would be able to, you know, combat inferences. And does that mean combat inferences with relate to perhaps his net worth? I mean, there was all those financial documents that were staring the arbitrator in the face. And I think one of your arguments is that, you know, they shouldn't have gone down the punitive road and that wasn't sufficient. But it just seems to me that the arbitrator, and you're saying this was a document case, had enough information at least to determine net worth and award the punitive damages.
I think that this court rejected that application, and I think maybe rightfully so. I'm not going to question that decision, and certainly the ICA thought that the punitive damages award should be affirmed. So in that regard, that limited areas to the financials only, yeah, I think that the arbitrator certainly had enough information. But I think Mr. Kyle's talking about the entire case in and of itself on statements on what he did, because he could make statements on...
You mean on liability? Are you saying he was going to contest liability after pleading?
Yeah, to some degree.
Okay.
Because it, in this case, Mr. Kyle's defense would have been something similar to why things were done the way that it was done, why the applications were made. And one of the other things he's always stressed is that he was at that time the 99% owner of the company, and the plaintiff was the 1% owner. So he would have contested liability. I think he would have contested damages the way the damages were calculated, not specifically the punitive damages, but I think the way the damages were calculated, he would have contested that.
I have a quick question, Mr. Kiyuchi, on the claims that were asserted in the arbitration proceeding, claims and counterclaims, versus the criminal charges. Is there anywhere in between that in your view, he could have testified that wouldn't have implicated his Fifth Amendment or Hawaii constitutional rights? Because here, the reason for my question is the arbitrator's reasoning was the survivability of the company, losing employees, et cetera. Doesn't that go more to just his disassociation?
It does. And I think there were a number of things that were done to mitigate those damages, like the dissociation.
The stipulations ahead of time.
Right. And a lot of things that were, and obviously those were decisions that were made by him, not verbally, but decisions made by him. So I think there were decisions that were done to mitigate those damages. Yes.
So my question is, in terms of was there a narrower solution other than stay the entire thing or allow the entire thing to go forward in light of your decision not to bifurcate?
In some essence, hindsight's always 20/20. But
right.
I think that was the right decision, because his testimony would have been so far-reaching had he not been subjected to taking Article 1, Section 10, and it would have been very hard to parse that out and separate it out. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Louis.
Thank you. May it please the court. Hawaii has long held that arbitrator decisions in private arbitrations are entitled to great deference, and this case is really no different than that. Here, the arbitration award was properly confirmed by the circuit court for three reasons. First, there's really no basis for vacature. Mr. Cao never showed sufficient cause, good cause, or really any cause that was sufficient for postponement. Postponement's a temporary delay. He wanted an indefinite delay for that. And the parties here stipulated to the Keating factors and stipulated to the arbitrator making that decision on the Keating factors, which are overwhelmingly endorsed by the courts. The arbitrator applied the Keating factors and found the existential threat outweighed the potential prejudice to Mr. Cao, and allowed Mr. Cao
to assert his Fifth Amendment right, his Article 1, Section 10 right, and so he didn't testify. The second reason is that, which has not yet been mentioned, is that the contract itself required the arbitration award to be completed within 120 days.
Yes, but that was September 1st, right?
Yes. But
and you didn't even start the hearing until September 27th.
There was a delay, and we consented. But
and the award wasn't until November.
That is true, and we consented to that. But the statute, the arbitration vacature statute, which refers to Section 15, Section 15 says that the arbitrator shall not postpone the arbitration beyond that specified in, by the parties unless there's consent. And there was never consent.
Well, you know what? I mean, if a contractual deadline conflicts with the Article 1, Section 5 due process right under our Constitution, Article 1, Section 10 right, wouldn't that contractual provision yield to the Constitution?
Not necessarily. In certain circumstances, you could have a contract right yield to the constitutional right, but you also have a U.S. constitutional right to not abrogate contracts. The states are not supposed to abrogate contracts. So I recognize certainly that there is a Article 1, Section 10 right that is here, but the arbitrator himself had to weigh the Keating factors and had to include that in that weighing the contract arbitration deadlines and put that all together and figure out what is the balancing of the interests, the totality of the circumstances.
Has this court ever greenlit the Keating factors?
No, it has not.
And you know, given Article 1, Section 10 and the adverse inference that flows from, you know, looking at the federal Constitution and the Keating, I mean, how does that flesh out on what we should decide as far as the framework here in Hawaii?
So I think that the Keating factors were appropriate and are appropriate for this court to use and apply in this situation where there's parallel civil and criminal proceedings. And especially, again, this is an arbitration, a private arbitration, which is even perhaps a more deferential standard than you would accord to a civil proceeding in a circuit court, something like that. And the Keating factors have been, while not greenlit by this court, certainly, or in Hawaii, numerous courts have found that. Nobody has found really a better way to protect the competing interests of civil plaintiffs and then criminal defendants where these things are both involved. And so that's why you have, and it's a case-by-case basis. All of the cases have held, it's you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances. You've got to balance the competing interests. You've got to figure out, you know, how to do that. And you accord a discretion to the decider. So like on a motion to continue a trial in criminal case, State versus Lee says that's an abuse of discretion standard. And so there's no reason to have higher standard than that.
I think I heard you say, you know, sort of the totality of circumstances, which I imagine would sort of look at what the case is all about. And your case touches upon national, you know, security implications. Now, in a one-party contract situation between X and Y, would your approach maybe shift? In other words, perhaps the balancing factors might, either be for or against the defendant and their right against self-incrimination. In other words, does the type of the case sort of matter when one looks at the balancing?
I think it matters hugely. And that's why you have to – there's no one-size-fits-all on this kind of a thing. Every case has unique factors, and this one had unique factors. And I think the critical unique factor is the existential exigent threat to the survival of this company. They'd lost a quarter of their employees already at that time. They had this FCL clearance in jeopardy. But more importantly – they were going to have to put down on every single application for a new contract that Martin Cow is st- still a 99% owner. They'd have to disclose that to every single defense entity that they approach for a contract. That would just kill their business.
So in your balancing, whether it's Keating, whether it's good cause, whatever it might be, it's the prejudice of the delay that really, in your view, outweighs the Article 1, Section 10, right?
In this case, specifically for this arbitration, in this case, because of the survival, justice delayed would have been justice denied for Navitech. So that's, I mean, a real problem. And I admit, you got to look at the individual factors in any given case. It's, you can't have a one-size-fits-all. You can say, this court could say, here's the factors. Go look at the factors. This is what we want you to look at. But then once somebody looks at those factors and makes that balancing test, I think they're entitled, especially in the arbitration context.
Okay. So, yeah, so that brings up, I guess, what I was sort of thinking about as well is, you know, we have an arbitration context, but we have, and I'm actually kind of surprised that this court's never truly weighed in on this issue, but you got family court, you got, you know, all sorts of situations where an individual might be either investigated or indicted, and have the possibility of, you know, exercising that right and possibly delaying things. What scheme, for lack of a better word, would you adopt? Is it Keating or is it something else?
I think the Keating factor provides a framework. Most of the courts have held that the Keating factors are fine. Some of the courts have added a couple of factors, looking at good faith of the parties or the status of the proceedings or something like that. But most of them have looked at that balancing thing, because you sometimes the circumstances are such that there is no heavy prejudice to the plaintiffs. There is no exigent threat, as here. In that situation, maybe there's more of a reason to delay and to allow that Article 1, Section 10 right to go forward, or to even allow the U.S. constitutional right, the Fifth Amendment right, to be the factor. So I think that...
So, counsel, it sounds like what you're saying, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Keating factors can be read broadly enough to maybe encompass some of these issues that you've brought up. So is it the Keating factors plus something else? What are you suggesting?
I think the Keating factors were fine, and they were stipulated and agreed to here. And the jurisprudence of this court has been where there is a stipulation as to the standard that is to be used by the parties. The courts have generally said, you know, been deferential to
that. I'm not sure if the case law it goes that way. It's stipulations, not in stipulations as to the law that applies in a civil case. Now, this is different because we're talking about an arbitration, and if the arbitrator applies the wrong legal standard, it doesn't really, you know, the courts are not supposed to review that, except here when you have constitutional rights at issue, right?
So I appreciate the constitutional dimension of that, but right. But in this case, the Keating factors are the ones that have actually been formulated to address these constitutional issues.
But it's pretty clear that the Fifth Amendment right has been interpreted not as strongly as Article 1, Section 10. You know, our case law, we provide such greater rights under our Article 1, Section 10 than federal courts do under the Fifth Amendment. And to the extent that even Keating says that you can draw adverse inferences from a person raising the fifth right against self-incrimination, whereas our case law is very clear that the state constitution does not allow it. And that's even codified in Rule 513 of the Hawaii Rules of Evidence. There is no comment or inference based on someone raising their right against self-incrimination in Hawaii courts. And so I think it's pretty clear that our rights are greater. So the issue is, to what extent is it greater and how do we balance that?
Right. And I certainly agree that Hawaii's jurisprudence has held that the Article 1, Section 10 rights are broader than those of the federal constitution and the federal courts. But there here in this case, there was no coercive state action, which this court has really said is a factor in many cases. Here, there were no self-incriminating statements. Mr. Cao asserted his right to not testify. There were no self-incriminating statements that brought forth.
What if he had requested bifurcation of just punitive damages?
You know, that is kind of a hypothetical speculation because it wasn't really properly raised. There's a question in my mind as to whether it was properly raised on cert here. But my point there, Justice, is that the statute and the contract time limit would have governed that. Because in that case, you would have had to take that beyond.
Are you suggesting that the operating agreement timeline is jurisdictional? I think you did say that.
We've said that.
Then the award itself is invalid. Unless because you consented only as to the post-hearing briefs and the final award. You're saying that is not jurisdictional because you consented to that, but not to anything else.
Correct. That is correct. As long as we consented, then you could go beyond the time limit, but it is jurisdictional otherwise. Incidentally, the case that Mr. Kiyuchi cited, the McKesson case.
There's federal case law saying that those time limits are procedural, not jurisdictional, right?
Yes, that's the McKesson case. And the McKesson case said that in a procedural situation, then the arbitrator decides as opposed to a court. And here the arbitrator made that decision, which was to have the hearing within the time limits as extended or agreed to by the parties. So in general, I agree with your position, Justice, there are broader protections. But the point I wanted to make was that this court has not gone so far as to adopt the blanket stay rule that Mr. Kiyuchi and Mr. Cao has been arguing, that just by the mere invocation of Article 1, Section 10, or the Fifth Amendment, bingo, you always get a stay. You always get essentially an unfair advantage over the civil plaintiffs. And so this court has not gone that far, and no court really has.
So, Mr. Louie, you know, that kind of goes to my question that I asked Mr. Kiyuchi earlier, which is, given the criminal charges on one hand, and given the civil claims in the arbitration, was there any room for some version of the proceeding in the arbitration to go forward that wouldn't implicate the criminal matters? In other words, let me rephrase this, which is, the key issue the arbitrator found for not staying was, as you pointed out, the existential threat to the companies, as well as the loss of employees, et cetera. So doesn't that go to the disassociation? So we've got damages claims here. We've got the punitive damages claims. You know, could those have been put aside and just the disassociation issues go forward and allowed him to testify? How do they either separate or do they overlap, the issues with regards to disassociation?
While it could have been done in the fashion that you've suggested, having the bifurcation that Mr. Kiyuchi has suggested, I think that would be a mistake because it would be very highly inefficient, and also a lot of overlap existed on both the disassociation, the issues of breach of fiduciary duty, the egregious conduct of Mr. Cao, and how that would relate to the punitive damages claim. And so you would get this thing of starting all over, 2 years, 3 years after the fact, and then somebody would have to try and revisit all of that testimony. So I think that would be not a good way to proceed. The other thing I would mention is that the actual financial consequences, which needed to be determined here, were important to the company because they had to determine, okay, how much, I mean, they're in a survival mode. What kind of finances are they going to have, and how are they going to deal with it? And then, are they going to have to pay this guy off? Are they not going to have to pay him off?
So
how is that going to work?
Also went to the survivor. The damages also went to the survivability of the company.
Yes, it did.
And you were also seeking to recoup money that you alleged Mr. Kyle had taken from the
Correct.
Company, right?
Yes. So because they were so intertwined, I don't think that it would have been practical to try and bifurcate.
I mean, you know, if somebody said, this is what we're going to do, you do whatever you have to do. But I don't think that would work that well.
Well, you know, I mean, these situations, you're balancing important rights on both sides, I think.
Yes.
And so that's the question. I mean, I think that's part of what I'm trying to understand, the practical implications and possibilities in this particular case, which fairly complex. But I guess specifically, what did you need to prove to disassociate Mr. Cao? It incorporated all of those breach of fiduciary duty claims as well as the other substantive claims in the arbitration as well, is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, all of those things needed to be done in order to disassociate him. I mean, it is not an easy thing for a 1% owner to disassociate a 99% owner, but the egregiousness of this guy's conduct was so bad that we believed that it was appropriate and important for the survival of the company. And so we had to do that, and we could, and we were able to do that. And I think the evidence was there. The evidence was presented, and he did not testify. No adverse inference was taken against him. There were no self-incriminating statements. And we did that all with the documents that came from the company itself, because those were company documents, the emails of Mr. Cao.
The arbitrator expressly stated, if I'm recalling, that he was taking no adverse inference,
yes,
right?
He okay. specifically said that on several occasions,
right?
Quite frankly. And so, you know, we think in this situation, because of the lack of any court ever saying that you always have a blanket right to stay these proceedings, and given the exigent circumstances here, they quite frankly really were going to die if they couldn't have gotten some relief. In that situation, for a private arbitration, we believe that that's appropriate for the arbitrator to have made the decision that he made, and appropriate for the circuit court to have confirmed it in this manner. And so we ask that, you know, the court affirm the confirmation by the circuit court in this case.
Counsel, if I can just go back to the
yes.
time limit. Is it your position then that no matter what, the arbitrator could not have continued the proceeding beyond that date or stayed the proceeding? That would have been error.
I think it would have raised the specter of error, because the vacature statute, 23A3, says that it incorporates Section 15. So Section 15 says you can't go beyond that date unless there's consent. And if the parties don't consent, it calls into question whether or not there's a valid award. And so my position is in this case alone, because of the time limits and because of the exigent circumstances that had to be recognized and had to be done. Could it be overridden in a different case? I don't know. I don't have a position on that. But in this case, that time limit was absolutely critical. And that's really the reason for arbitrations. Faster, hopefully cheaper, but without appeals necessarily. And that's why the legislature and this court have approved and encouraged arbitrations. And so we don't want to undermine that. We don't want to erode all of that jurisprudence. So in this case, that yes, that statute should have been respected.
Getting back to and sort of touching on something that Jessica Noza said, I mean, so as I see it, you know, it's almost the degree of this overlap, this factual overlap, the similarities between maybe the civil and the criminal action that, in your view, is a substantial factor in balancing the stay issue. Is that accurate?
Yes, I agree with that. I think all of those factors together are part of that balancing test that the arbitrator or you know, whoever's going to make this kind of a decision has to take into account. In this case,
and in your case, yes. You're saying there's absolutely virtually no way, because they were just so linked, that this could have happened.
Yes, that is correct. And because of the so in a different case, if you didn't have the exigency, the survival issue here, then maybe an arbitrator might do something different. A court reviewing it might do something different. But here, when you're talking about the existential threat,
I think it was an appropriate thing for the arbitrator to do, and I think it's appropriate for the circuit court to affirm that, to confirm that. Mm-hmm. And we ask that this be affirmed. If for any reason this court decides to enunciate a new standard or say something different or not affirm, I would ask that that only be prospective and not be done in a retrospective manner, a retroactive manner.
Well, aren't you saying that no matter what standard this court comes up with, you win?
Yes, I believe so. We should, under these circumstances. Unless this court were to disregard the existential threat or to disregard the discretion of the arbitrator in this case, I do think we win. I think we should win. That upholds policies of this legislature, upholds policies of this state, and I think it's the correct thing on these facts. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kiyuchi, rebuttal.
Thank you. I first want to address the 120-day rule, which is not a rule. It's basically in the arbitration, the operating agreement. Mr. Louis is correct. I did cite the McKesson v. Local 150 IBT case. It actually did come up in front of Judge Chang. Mr. Chin, who was arguing for the company at that point, has acknowledged it exceeded the 120 days, but they were not going to agree that it be farther out. But the whole point is that I think McKesson states the proper rule was that it's procedural and not jurisdictional. So I think the 120-day rule is, I would argue, is not a bar. In looking at Keating, I mean, the problem with Keating is especially the second factor in Keating is looks at the burden which any particular aspect of the proceedings may impose on defendants. That really understates what that should be in this case, especially given Article 1, Section 10. It doesn't speak to, in the Keating case, the assertion of the Fifth Amendment. And I think that's pretty significant because...
Isn't that a very broad language, though, for a factor?
Yes.
Could it not fit in with the Article 1, Section 10?
It could, but the problem is that it's almost too broad when you look at the factors, and it's really the only factor that measures in favor of the defendant, in favor of Mr. Cao. And it kind of changes him in that regard. And while maybe that's the whole problem, is that one size doesn't fit all, especially when you have a situation where you've got an assertion of a right against self-incrimination under Article 1, Section 10, or in a broader basis on a Fifth Amendment basis. But I do think that that language to me is troublesome, and I would say if this court's going to adopt Keating, that should be looked at, as well as in look at factor 3, the convenience of the court and management of its cases and efficient use of judicial resources. That doesn't apply in an arbitration case and certainly doesn't apply here. I don't know how that gets tweaked in terms of arbitration cases, but that's a little bit different. I would not advocate adopting Keating. I think that this court's correct that they have never actually adopted Keating, and I think there are reasons why Keating should not be adopted. I think
it's interesting. Keating lists the plaintiff's interest first.
Right, it does. And if you look at the interests, three of the four main interests are plaintiff's interests and not defendant's interests. So it's kind of skewed in one way. The fifth factor, the interest of the public in a pending civil and criminal litigation, kind of give you the indication that it deals with a much broader.
How do we not skew it in one way then?
I think that that's an interesting question, because three could be. I don't think three should come into play at all, because this was not a court proceeding; it was an arbitration proceeding. So that should be a non-factor.
But overall, how do we craft factors?
I think it's really one and two. I think you balance one, you balance two, you put the interests of the parties in, persons not parties to the civil litigation in part of one. I think that's really what should happen. I think it's really a weighing of those two factors. I think the other three factors should be non-factors. That's what I would argue. And it certainly, two, again, gives short shrift to defendants. And Justice McKenna is right. It's interesting. It's kind of weighted in that way, and it's really not fair to defendants in most proceedings. So, you know, it's another reason why this court should really consider that. I think that I want to emphasize that Mr. Cao really was kind of handcuffed in this case because he could testify. And this is, again, not a situation where plaintiff did not have documents. And while plaintiff said they had all the documents, that's actually not 100% correct because Mr. Cao produced over 120 documents. So, you know, this was, in some respect, a case where all of the documents were there. The main factor that was missing was Mr. Cao. It was missing because he asserted his rights under Article 1, Section 10. And I would ask the court to vacate the circuit court decision on that basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you to counsel. Thank you.
Iluna, please rise.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne, kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'ike hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.